Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. We are joined today by Alicia Tao. At the end of today's podcast, you can listen to the entire song that was written for today's episode. So as we were talking about how to do this week's episode, this week feels really heavy, right? As we're recording here, it's been just over a week since George Floyd was killed. And since then, a few more people have been killed in Omaha and Louisville are two that I'm aware of. You know, the protests and riots, and one of our mutual friends was posting on Facebook a video in which he said that this has been the hardest week of his life. He's a white man who lives in North Minneapolis. And as he was reflecting on that, he was talking about how he was apologizing to his Black brothers and sisters, saying, "This has been the hardest week of my life, but you live with this all the time." And I think that actually that kind of captures some of the difficulty that we've had in processing how to do this episode, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to make it seem like now that white people in Minneapolis are all of a sudden being awakened to the injustice that's been happening in our city, that this is actually something new. On the other hand, I'm grateful that there are a lot of my friends who've never spoken up on issues of race and issues of justice as it comes to race in the city, that they're now saying something about it. But it's that tension, isn't it, of wanting to be able to mourn with the community, with what's happening, mourn with the state that we're in our country, while at the same time understanding that our voices aren't the most important voices right now in the conversation, that we really need to hear from folks who maybe haven't been given as much opportunity to speak about this as they need to be given. And so that's some of my hesitation actually also in talking about this, is I don't want to give off the impression like, here I am and I've got some great insight that I can offer, as if my voice should be pressed to the front of the conversation. When really I'd prefer to be an advocate and to be supportive of anything that needs to happen to create change, while at the same time wanting to hear from others who have far more insight to say on the issue and who need to share their experiences with this and with how they've been treated in our country.
Yeah. Speaking of, so I'm grateful to have with us this morning Alicia Tao, who's the community engagement director with River Life Church in St. Paul. She's been in this role for 6 years, going on 7 years, and also works at the League of Minnesota Cities as a work comp examiner. She was part of the race equity team there for 3 years. She went to Toccoa Falls College in Georgia and received a bachelor's in music and her master's in global and contextual studies at Bethel Seminary. She loves to travel and try new restaurants. So this last couple of months has probably been rough as far as those two hobbies go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, completely.
So I met Alicia through, we have a class on urban ministry, and several times we've taken students into the cities, and Alicia's met with the students and led different reflections and different seminars for those groups. And that has been one of the highlights of that class, for sure. Students really, yeah, have enjoyed interacting with you, and I'm glad to have you with us here.
Thank you.
So, Alicia, are you in St. Paul? Is that where you're located?
I'm in St. Paul. For St. Paul folks, I'm on like right by Maryland and Wiper Avenue, right near the city. And then the neighboring town is, I think, Maplewood, Oakdale. So
what's the last week been like for you?
Oh, gosh. Exhausted, sad, angry, scared. We are close to River Life Church, where, and that River Life is located right by 3M headquarters. So we're literally a block away. But when we bought a house a couple years ago, we were intentional about staying in St. Paul because of the work that I do. I really wanted to be able to live what I was teaching and preaching to other people. So we stayed in St. Paul, and the rioting and looting happened over in Sunrise area, which is right next to River Life Church. And that evening, they traveled along White Bear Avenue and, you know, tour of the businesses on Whitefair Avenue as well. And I literally am two blocks from Whitefair Avenue. So all night, all I heard was sirens and fireworks and explosions and shootings. And my husband and I were just afraid for our lives. And I can't imagine what everyone around us was feeling, especially even in Minneapolis. But that night, I kid you not, I slept with a bat and my husband slept with a sword because we have video cameras around our house. But at midnight, when we checked the cameras, at about 11:20 p.m., there was a man that walked around our house twice. And we were like, well, we don't know who he is. When you live somewhere long enough, you know all your neighbors. You kind of know who their friends and families are. You know what cars they drive. And we just didn't know who this man was. So it was freaky. And even as I was dozing off, I could hear sirens. And that just shook me. And so it was a really rough week. And every night there's been shootings nearby. A few nights ago, there was a car lit on fire a few streets away. And so there has been a lot of unrest, but it's gotten better, I guess. That has just been a day by day thing. And every day is different.
It's really interesting. When we had talked about you coming on to the podcast, what we wanted to talk about was an Asian American experience of COVID, which also is dealing with racial issues, racism. And then, since then, racism against Black people in particular has come into focus again. And so it feels like, in some ways the conversation has moved forward. Justin and I were noticing that more of our white friends and family are engaging the issue than we've ever seen before. But it's not like racism against Asian Americans went away because we're focusing on this. How has it been for you to navigate kind of both of those worlds at the same time?
I think that initially when COVID hit and it was being called the Chinese virus and we were being a target, that brought on a new fear of like, okay, how do I prepare myself when I leave the house? What am I doing? Do I need to bring my pepper spray? Do I need to check my surroundings when I walk outside? Am I shopping by myself or am I bringing someone with me? So we started to build a new way of life. Just my husband and I, when we go for a walk, grab the pepper spray. Where's the pepper spray? It was always part of our conversation now. And then since the death of George Floyd, the narrative or the shift for me has been, how can we bring focus to our African brothers and sisters? Because the truth is that they have gone through way more than us in regards to oppression and trauma. And here I am trying to find my pepper spray, honestly, that is not going to protect me. What is going to help all of us is tackling institutional racism. And that is such a huge monster in itself, where it's like, where do we start? How do we even do this? And how do I play a role in this? What does my gifts and talent, how far will that take me? And that's been the bigger question for Meng and I, my husband and I, is just like, where do we step into this narrative? And how do we fight this?
Mm-hmm. I saw an article yesterday entitled Black Fear and Distrust in Hmong America. Did you see that?
No.
Okay. It was talking about kind of the particular history that some Hmong people have with African Americans and that coming to the U.S. from a conflict situation and then coming into often communities of poverty, that for some Hmong people, the transition here was really negative. And for some, that was associated with African-American people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if that's a common conversation or...
It is. It is a very common conversation. I think that Asians typically, we don't really fight back. We don't even talk back if we are not confident. And I have to say majority of us, even if we were confident, we're just not fighters in that same sense with our words and with our actions. So when we encounter racist slurs or actual attacks, we're not ready or prepared and know how to respond. Growing up, I have had, African-American kids throw rocks at me and I would try to fight back by yelling and crying and people had to intervene. But those incidents did not stop me from loving the African-American community, because those are isolated events. If I were to take that moment and let it define my whole life and how I view the African-American community, that would be wrong and incorrect. But our parents have endured a different kind of oppression. Obviously, my parents never spoke out, never spoke back, never fought back, and I'm very different from them. So in some ways, my parents and our generation, whether their generation, has some type of negative feelings towards the African-American community. And not everyone, but some have had really negative encounters.
So then I saw a picture, I think you were at the Capitol maybe, with a sign that said Hmong for Black Lives. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
Like, so that there are layers then to that. That's that's a significant statement.
Mm-hmm. When I actually lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for, 10 years of my life. And from third grade until 12th grade, majority of my friends were African American, and we did life together. We did school together, and they were some of my best friends growing up. And I think about the love I had for them and the friends I have now. Why would it be any different? Let's say one of my friends was in place of George Floyd. Heck yeah, I would be angry and I would protest. And it doesn't matter if I knew George Floyd or not. I'm still on the front lines of, let's fix this. Let's fight this. This is wrong. And no one else should have to go through this. So when I held up that sign, Hmong for Black Lives Matter, that's because I have had amazing African-American friends in my life. They were like family to me. So I want to stand in solidarity with them and say, I love all of you and support you. Your life is just as important as mine or anyone else's.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've been wrestling with is trying to figure out the solutions to these problems and trying to figure out how to tackle the concept of systemic racism that you'd mentioned. I'm seeing a lot of movement on social media in terms of people making statements, people, you know, doing the Blackout Tuesday yesterday on Instagram. And for me, I don't want to be overly critical, but there's something about that that just feels so minor in the big scheme of things, as if, you know, my white friend's Instagram posts to black out their account for a day is somehow going to change the world. Again, I don't want to be dismissive. Mm-hmm. I think it's good for people who have not been making statements on race to now begin making them. But how do we process through that? You know, what there are these little steps that people have been taking to try to combat the systemic racism by speaking out in ways they haven't previously done. But it seems like that is just such surface level, you know, movement. How do we move from those kinds of things, you think, to bigger, more substantial changes when it comes to systemic racism?
Well, that's a really good question. And I'm still wrestling with it myself every day. And I think it's really good to bring awareness by letting everyone in your circles or your friends and family know that you support something and that racism is not okay. But I really think that we have to go beyond just changing our Facebook status and posting pictures, which I am an extrovert, so I do all the time. But we have to engage ourselves with organizations and with our workplaces and with our churches, where we're having conversations on a normal basis. It doesn't have to be every day, but it needs to be part of our conversations in our life. And it can be done in different ways. So one of the ways that I've done it in my own family is, like, my nephew, I took him to go see a play, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. It was a children's play. And he was about 9 at the time. And we went and saw the whole play. And then afterwards, we sat and we talked about it. And he talked about his African-American friends at school and was able to connect the story that he had watched and heard. And he really walked away with some really good things. And this year, he read the book in school and he came and he was so excited. He said, Auntie, I want to tell you that I read the book in school. school, but I'm ahead of the class because I already saw the play, nice. You know? And I said, yes, yes. You know, like he was able to process the book even more. And then the same a nephew, I had a conversation with him about immigration, just letting him know about what's happening in the world, especially at the border of Mexico and the US. And we had some really good conversations. Like he had good questions. And so I think it's allowing children, young children, to talk about what they're experiencing around them, especially around racism. And then having these ongoing conversations, because our youth kids are going to be the ones entering college. They're the ones that are going to become our future leaders. So we have to start when they're young. And that's part of it, right? But we're talking now, we're talking about like the bigger picture. How can we plug ourselves in, connecting with organizations, talking about how our church culture is like. If a church has been put in place 100 years ago and they started their bylaws 100 years ago, who's to say that those bylaws still apply to us today? Can we take a look at them? Can we tweak them? Can we rethink some of it? And I know that there's been a lot of, oh, you know, let's not abandon the gospel. I don't think we're abandoning the gospel. I think we are really taking the time to figure out how the gospel looks even more so in our current context. But the next thing is to vote, to figure out who is running for what position. You can't just expect your school district to be amazing if you're not going to vote for the people who are going to run your school district. You can't expect the government that we have now is going to be the way it is if you're not going to vote. You can change your Facebook status all you want, but if you're not going to go out and vote for the right people that you feel will do the best job in education and healthcare in our country, even our local elected officials within our neighborhood, if you don't know who is representing you, you just really can't expect what you want out of all of this. And then if workplaces are offering you race equity events, go to them. There have been so many people of color that sometimes I'm like, hey, there's an event today, make sure you show up. You know, I shouldn't have to, you know, urge people of color to go to these events, but I do. And that's frustrating. Some of us are working so hard, and then some of us are like, they just want to sit on the side to say, I've done a little part and I'm good. I'm good. You guys got the rest. So that's frustrating.
I think what's so interesting is I think what I appreciate about what you're saying is there's not one thing, right? It's in every area of life. These are things we need to be thinking about and figuring out how to relate ourselves to. And I think what's interesting is where you started, you were talking about the conversations that we have at home, right? Like with your nephew. And I'm thinking about some of the conversations I've had with my kids. And what one of the things that I'm wrestling with is maybe the connection between that and what you were mentioning in terms of the gospel. Because I feel like one of the barriers that I've seen among white folks to really actually pressing in to racism is this feeling of the need to defend our own innocence. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the pushback that I see on social media and things that I've seen, you know, face to face, having conversations with people, it has to do with this idea of innocence. And yeah, the question of what is, you know, if I admit that I have prejudice or if I admit my own racism, that somehow that makes me not the kind of person that I think that I am. Mm-hmm. And so there's really a gospel question in there. But I guess, I mean, Justin, does that match with what you're seeing with people's defenses? Are they kind of around this issue of innocence or?
Yeah, and I think it matches up some with what James Willits shared with us a few weeks ago on our podcast, which is this sort of myth that racism is based on the bad eggs or the bad apples, right? There are bad people who are racist, and then there are the rest of us, right? And I think that myth has contributed to some of the fear around examining ourselves and our role in the bigger systems that exist. Because if we find prejudice, and if we find those inklings within us, then does it mean we're a bad egg? I think that's what's so helpful about dismantling that myth in some ways, that it's a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. But I have seen that on social media and whatnot, the sense of, well, it's not my fault kind of thing, mm-hmm. right? Coming from a lot of white folks. Or it's been this realization of, well, it's not directly my fault, but I understand there are these systems that are contributing to it, and now I want to speak out against it. But
can still be a way of maintaining personal innocence, right?
Yeah. And honestly, and even one thing I'd looked at yesterday in light of the Blackout Tuesday, and Stephen, I sent you this, is just this idea of like, and so people now need to hear my voice, is what some of my white friends are feeling. Like, I don't want to be silent anymore. But there's a sense of irony too, in that, you know, they were suggesting that yesterday when people, especially white folks, were doing Blackout Tuesday on Instagram, that it was actually muting some of the voices that needed to be heard because everyone's feeds were just flooded with blacked out pictures, and especially when it's associated with a hashtag like Black Lives Matter. So there are people who are crying out saying, quit this. If you want to let Black voices be heard, then don't put the hashtag on there, because when people are looking for information under the hashtag Black Lives Matter, they don't need to see a bunch of blacked out boxes of white folks' Instagram feeds. So there's this sense though, almost of like, okay, there's movement that we're wanting to see from white people not being silent, but at the same time, there's this sense of frustration almost of like, but there's this counterproductive activity that's going on that's actually kind of contributing. It's almost a wonder. I chose not to do the Blackout Tuesday. I chose not to post anything on social media, not because I want to be silent, but because I feel like I don't want my voice to be pushed to the front of the conversation. I want others to be able to have the opportunity to speak, and I want to be an advocate, but it's frustrating for me to feel like a lot of my white friends are saying, all right, now it's time for me to speak up. So hear me, as if their voice is maybe the most important in the conversation. And I wonder if that's motivated by the sense of either wanting to be innocent, like you mentioned, Stephen, or at least wanting to shift the attention a little bit on themselves. And I'm not criticizing all my friends who are doing this, because some of them certainly have strong positive motivations, but I don't know always how to navigate that. What role... this is maybe a separate question. We kind of addressed a little bit. What positive roles can social media actually play in the movement? And how do people, to me, everything just feels so cheap right now in some ways when it's done on social media. It doesn't take much sweat equity. It doesn't take much commitment beyond me just simply reposting something, besides me, you know, jumping on the bandwagon of Blackout Tuesday. I just kind of wonder when the dust settles a couple weeks from now on some of the heat and intense rioting that's been happening in Minneapolis, are my same friends who have been posting these things on Instagram going to be advocates, or are they going to go back to their normal lives? And I have to say, it's not like I've got some sustained plan on how to become the advocate, you know, for the issue. I'm at a loss of words. I don't know even where to begin in some ways, mm-hmm. but it's what the social media component feels kind of cheap to me on. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think if we use social media for communicating efforts that are being done, such as rebuilding, I think that's super important. That people can continue to step into that space and say, hey, I am an advocate, I stand in solidarity, but I'm also going to join in with the rebuilding. Our district in St. Paul has asked us to partner with them. They're going to hold a peace vigil this Saturday, and our pastors are going to participate with some words of comfort, and we're also going to try to do a food drive, pass out to our families in the area. So I think it is the ongoing, the regular consistent posts about where I stand, how I support people, that is the most powerful piece, versus let me just post like 30 posts now about this and then never talk about it again in the future. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In light of your role at River Life, I'd be interested just to hear, you know, what particular role can the church play right now in the midst of the things that are happening in the city and the midst of discussions about racial justice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we definitely need to be in prayer, because right now we're fighting darkness that's not physical. There's a lot of emotions that are high, anxiety, depression. We have darkness that we need to push back on. And then having places for conversation is very important. Because if you're not used to having a lot of conversations, organized conversations about race, that is super challenging. And that's something that we are still working towards doing. We've done it before in the past, but I think it needs to be ongoing. Last Sunday, we had a prayer and Stephen was part of it as well. And we just poured our hearts out to God about what we were experiencing. I mean, as an Asian church, we have conversations about how we feel about being Asian on a daily basis. It's just not talked about. I mean, we don't put it on social media. We don't message anyone and say, hey, today I had a conversation about how I was Asian and white people were prejudiced towards me. You know, we just don't talk about all that we go through in an organized manner. So I think the church really needs to create space for that. But then for the pastors to talk about racism right from the pulpit, I think that's very important to just say, this is not okay, or this is okay. And how can we step into the space of healing and grieving and empathizing and understanding others who look different from us? So our church has white folks. We have Africans. We actually have African Americans. So we have different pockets of people at our church, and we need to create space for all of them as well.
I've been encouraged because I see there's some unprecedented things happening even within denominations. I noticed, you know, the Christian Missionary Alliance is putting together a forum tonight, you know, and President Stumbo is going to be carrying on a conversation about race issues. And I think that those sort of unprecedented conversations are really encouraging. At the same time, there's something in me that says this kind of thing has been happening in the U.S. nonstop for so long. And there's a sense of sadness almost in me, like, why now? And this isn't to be at all dismissive of the events that have happened in our city, but this has happened before in our city, and it's been happening around the country.
Like, there was something especially horrible
for sure
about the death of George Floyd, but there have been things that have been especially horrible about the deaths of a lot of people, right?
Exactly. And that's some of my frustration is on the one hand, I want to celebrate and say, yes, okay, this is great movement. This is unprecedented movement. And I don't know why it took this particular incident and not any of the other incidences that have happened, even in the last 5 years in the country. For some reason, it was this incident. And you're right, Stephen, there's something about it that was particularly egregious and shocking and horrifying, and rightly so. But I also wonder, well, where were we? Why weren't our eyes opened in the last 5 years even? I mean, Colin Kaepernick started taking a knee how long ago? And not many white folks were listening. And so why then is it this particular thing that has caused this awakening? And on the one hand, we can celebrate it because, yes, it's causing this awakening. On the other hand, we have to, it's almost a lament for me, like, why now and not all those other times?
And I think my hopeful response to that is that maybe God is stirring the church. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's why, you know, but that's what I hope is happening. But I think the evidence of that, you know, like you're saying, will go way beyond, you know, what somebody posts. I mean, so it's Wednesday, right? I got on Facebook just a little bit this morning and I feel like the conversation is already drifting away, which is fascinating, right? So yesterday there's this big, you know, Blackout Tuesday thing. And then today it feels like and who knows, maybe it's Facebook's algorithm, but what I'm seeing today is much less about racism. It's much less about George Floyd. It's, you know, I mean, we haven't even had his funeral yet.
Kind of like we've done this, right?
Right.
Yeah. So the idea is almost like, we had our Tuesday where we make a statement. Now let's move on with life.
And I'm thinking about one of our grads, Taylor Patz on Facebook, had this really good conversation that she shared. And she said, so she was talking with one of her Black friends in Mississippi. And he said, honestly, you and others speaking against police brutality is like someone telling me they're sorry or sending condolences after a loved one passes. It's nice and all, but I'm still thinking about my loved one. You can say sorry, but it doesn't really make a difference. And then she goes on to talk about how the boycott after Rosa Parks in 1955 was 381 days long.
Wow.
And just the need for consistency. Mm-hmm. I mean, she says in her post, you know, after a couple of weeks, the situation is all going to blow over and we're going to forget until the next, you know, really egregious example of police brutality happens to be captured. Right. And, you know, So you, for Alicia, for 3 years, I think you were on the race equity team, mm-hmm. for the League of Minnesota Cities. I mean, so you've been in some of this longer term work. Like, what do you notice about, you know, trying to engage these things for the long haul?
Yeah, it is so exhausting, and you hit so many dead ends. Sometimes you're like, yeah, we're doing great, but then it's one step forward and three steps back. Or it's like very small baby steps, and it's going, but it's going, and it's going. That's how I feel when you're doing race equity work. But there's a lot of positive hopes because it continues to have a space in our organization, and it has now moved into impacting the cities in Minnesota. So it's been very, very nice to see, but it has been very long, 3 years. I took a break because I was exhausted from doing church planting, race equity, maintaining a full-time job. Both my families live here, and I just said, you know, I just need a mental break from just being part of it. But when we started with trying to figure out what that looks like for our organization, we had a lot of training. There was a lot of conversations and training with other city members about starting an action plan. And the thing about white people is that they're so good about being organized. Everything has to be on paper, on a chart. We have to wordsmith for hours to make sure we're saying the right thing. And that's awesome. I love that. But, you know, as an Asian person, it doesn't really help me. I mean, but it will help in the long run. So that was where I had to sit and say, Alicia, it is not about right now. It is about the future. It is about tackling institutional racism. So then it made sense to me. But it is a very long process to look through everything. Right now, the organization is going through reviewing policies, and every department had to find one policy that they had to put through the race equity lens tool. And that was just really cool to see, because now they're taking things apart and they're looking at the one policy and saying, how is this one policy impacting people of color? How is it impacting our organization? How is it excluding people of color? And I think that in some ways, we in our own lives need to do that, take things apart and look at why we believe what we believe. Is it being exclusive of people of color in our own life, or is it being inclusive? And, you know, that is something that we could practice, or even in the church, taking apart the things that we believe in and thinking about how it's impacting others. I think that we just need to do the legwork. It is not easy, but we have to try.
Where do you find strength and peace as you, you know, press into the long haul of those kinds of initiatives?
I find my peace and my strength through, and it sounds very cliche, but through God. My race equity team knew that I was the community engagement director at my church. And I just have felt really called by God to step into places that are not super popular. I know that even as a woman leader in the Hmong church, I've gotten a lot of backlash for being a director or being a leader for even speaking out, because I'm the noisy Asian woman, and I've gotten a lot of feedback about all of that. And so I had to find my peace in God and say, God, if you have called me to do this, you will see me through in every opportunity. And that was been my own strength as well. When I finished Bethel Sem, I actually was like, God, I have no idea where I'm going to serve. So for 3 years, I didn't serve at all. I didn't go to any, I just went to a mega church as just attended on Sunday, and I didn't do anything because I had no idea what I would do as a Hmong woman. And then River Life came along and that changed everything. And everything that I have put my mind to, God has blessed, or He has opened doors, or He has brought partners. And that is where I find my peace and strength. It's, okay, if you want this to happen, it will happen. And I'm not going to say no to you, and I'm not going to not do it. But I need you to go before me, because in our culture and in our church culture, I'm not necessarily accepted.
Recently, I saw two political cartoons that depicted Jesus, and they depicted him very, very differently. And it was relative to the current circumstance. One of them had Jesus kind of above the earth, kind of looking over the earth with this, you know, finger pointing out, you know, saying, "Stop it!" The other showed Jesus as a protester, crouched down on the ground, holding a sign and being beat by one of these police in riot gear. I mean, it looked like it was taken from an image I'd seen in the news, right? But it replaced the person who'd been protesting with Jesus. And I'm curious, as you think about Jesus right now, like what images do you have in mind?
I see Jesus portrayed as a white man. But I've moved away from that. I think that if people could see him not as a middle-class white man, things would be different.
Yeah. In what ways have you seen Jesus in the last week?
I have seen him allow people to speak out against injustice. I have seen him bring people to their knees to pray for our cities. I have seen Jesus step into space to help board up businesses and to help care for people, to help protect people. I have seen Jesus help clean up. I've seen him and his angels protecting people during the riots and the looting. I mean, the semi truck drove through the highway into a crowd of protesters. That is definitely the hand of God protecting people. What about you guys?
I think theologically speaking, I understand when we say when people see the church, they see Jesus. On the other hand, I'm frightened by that notion sometimes, because I think it can go the other way, that sometimes people's view of Jesus is skewed because it's really their view of the church. And what I mean by that is a negative thing, right? Like the church fails, or the church, you know, doesn't stand up against issues of racism, or the church doesn't speak out when it should, or the church, you know, maintains these systemic things with racism. And then I think people think, well, that's Jesus. But to me, sometimes it's a helpful thing to understand that the flawedness of the human church, spirit-led at times, right? but in positive ways, but the flawedness of the human church, while also maintaining that, like, we can see Jesus in this when the church is even failing. And I'm not saying we have failed entirely when it comes to everything that's happening right now, but to me it is helpful. So I think when you're saying the way that you see Jesus working, I want to totally affirm that. And other times I want to say when the church is silent, Jesus wouldn't have been. When Jesus talks about...
And vice versa, right? Sometimes when the church speaks, Jesus wouldn't have.
Wouldn't have. Yeah. And I'm thinking about just key passages when Jesus talks about working towards the least of these and caring for the least of these. And as you've done it unto me, you know, or as you've done it unto them, you've done it unto me, and vice versa. The extent to which you did not do this to them, you did not do this to me. Like, all of those claims that Jesus makes is solidarity with the poor, with the oppressed, with the overlooked, with the outcast. I think of Jesus when he talks about banquets, and he's talking about all the people who are invited, all the best and brightest at the time who are invited and turned down the invitation. And Jesus says, but the person went into the streets, he invited the poor and the disabled and the, you know, this category of people within ancient Israel, I think, that were the most overlooked in society. And so I tend to find Bible reading helpful and tend to see Jesus in ways sometimes that he's not showing up in the church. And Jesus is showing up in the church with some of those things. And I think you pointed that out. That's fantastic. But I think it's good sometimes also to get back to the scriptures and to actually see who Jesus is in light of what he said and what he did, and that we can see Jesus's presence in the midst of all of this in new, profound ways when we see how deeply he cared for people who were overlooked and outcast and oppressed, and how he himself was in many ways as well. And so, I don't know, for me, I don't see Jesus as this, you pointed out, the middle class kind of white person who maybe has privilege and who receives, I don't know, protection from all of the issues that people are going through with race. I think Jesus would be present in the midst of that in ways that he would be rejected and scorned now as he was then.
I think there are two images that stick in my mind this week. There are more, like both of you said, you know, in seeing the church. I mean, I think honestly, Alicia, seeing you at the Hmong for Black Lives Matter at the Capitol, I think was one of those moments where it's like, this is something that Christ can do in us that we often can't do in ourselves. Yeah. But the two images that really stick in my mind, one was, there's a video I saw of a Black woman in New York speaking truth to white protesters who had come and who had begun to riot, right? Had begun to be destructive. And she spoke for several minutes truth about who lived there and was clearly intimately connected with the vulnerable people who lived there. And at the same time that she was speaking truth on behalf of the vulnerable and really identifying with the vulnerable people there, she also, at least in the clip that I saw, she didn't diminish the humanity of those who had come to protest. And I thought that reminded me of Christ in the sense that, like, you know, like you were saying, Justin, this identification with the most vulnerable, right? Which is that Matthew 25 idea. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, this openness to an acknowledgement of the humanity of those in power, of the influential. And I think there's something so important about the way that Jesus humanizes everyone that he comes into contact with.
At the same time.
Oh, yeah, good.
At the same time. I don't want to think of a Jesus who just simply is in solidarity with the oppressed. Jesus was brutally outspoken against the oppressors. Brutally. Not all of them, because Rome was oppressing, and Jesus doesn't, you know, come flat out and call out Rome in every which way. But to the extent that some of the leadership within Israel at the time was oppressive, Jesus had no problem calling woes upon them. And we see that kind of prophetic trend actually even throughout the Old Testament. So I don't know, if there's this balance, isn't there, of a Jesus in complete solidarity with the oppressed and the overlooked and the outcast and the poor, and yet Jesus refusal to just stand by and not speak out. There's a sense of prophetic woes that he calls upon the oppressors and upon those who are creating problems in ways that so brutally need to be called out. I don't know. It's that balance, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of what I loved in that video of that woman was there was this fierce protection of people, which meant, I mean, she was very much calling out really the hypocrisy of the protesters, right? Which is a lot of what Jesus was calling out.
And frankly, I mean, maybe it's time for a reinvigorated reading of Revelation in our context, because of how engaged the book of Revelation is with the concept of Roman imperial oppression and idolatry and all of that, and how Jesus is depicted as the Lamb who conquers and yet who will overcome the injustices that the Christians were facing in the Roman Empire. I don't know. It's interesting how we've read it simply as this sort of futuristic book that's somehow going to predict the end times, and we haven't really read it as this deeply liberating call to Jesus seated on the throne, where all oppressive systems will dissolve under the rule of Jesus, the earthly rule of Jesus, which has not yet happened, but which we await, you know, one day. I mean, that's a hopeful message. I'd love to see a reinvigorated reading of Revelation during this time.
I want to come back to my second image of Christ this week, but I'm curious, Alicia, would this thought of Jesus as, you know, calling out the oppressors while also standing with the oppressed and but then the humanizing all around, like how do you think through all of that?
I think that it starts with relationships, and Jesus is all about loving and caring for your neighbors and your brothers and sisters and family and friends, and not neglecting the people around you. And I think it is powerful to be able to call out the injustices, but also at the same time, I think Jesus is all about love. So you need to have a good balance of both. And I think Jesus really talks about how to do that well. And we don't do that well. Some people are just really good about calling out things, but not loving. Some people are really great at loving, but not calling out things. So how can we have a balance between the two? And it is within the relationships that you build with people in the community and your family and friends. So when you call out stuff, people know you do it out of love, not necessarily out of hate and out of anger, but out of a deep, meaningful relationship, because we're called to have deep, meaningful relationship with Jesus, to let him know how we're feeling, to lament, to cry to him, to pray to him, to trust in him, and yet also to be bold and confident to speak out when there is abuse in the picture, or when there is neglect, or when people are being oppressed for whatever reasons that people are being oppressed for. And I think I want to go back to the earlier part when I said, you know, for me, I think growing up, Jesus was a white middle-class man for me. And for a very long time, I just couldn't connect as an Asian girl or an Asian woman. And then over the years, I had to really learn and understand who Jesus was for me. And he was someone who came and died for me. And because I'm an Asian person, that was 100% okay, that I didn't have to be white to know that I could be saved. And I struggled with that growing up, knowing that I just thought he came for white people, even though the Bible talked a lot about going to the ends of the earth with my message. I just didn't feel like it was for me as an Asian person. And I think it's the way that the churches were designed. We were modeling after the typical evangelical church and then just throwing culture in. And so then we get this white church with the cultural overlay and then not feeling like Jesus was really for me as an Asian person.
And I wonder too, when you think about the trauma that Hmong people came to the U.S. with, if the white church that was helping Hmong people get started here was not also addressing trauma, right? Like, was the gospel in some ways, did we fail to see the ways in which the gospel was relevant to that trauma and to let the gospel speak into that?
Yeah, I see that now. There's a lot of refugees in the Twin Cities, and I wonder how we can speak into that. I think about the trauma that we have had and how I didn't find comfort in scripture or Jesus or the Bible when I was trying to understand my ethnicity and who I was and the trauma that my parents had gone through. How can we do that now? And I think about the refugees who have just arrived or within the past couple of years, and they're stepping into the quarantine and into the institutional racism the death of George Floyd. And it's like, how would they even process what Jesus is, who Jesus is in America?
That's such a rich question. And it's one that I don't think we can answer well isolated from each other. You know, it's something that, you know, talking with you, I'm seeing more pictures of who Jesus is, right? And as I talk with my Black friends, you know, it's the same. And then also in my life, right? Who is Jesus? Like, and somehow, I think one of the beautiful things about Christ is he's infinite, right? And so it's not surprising that we would see this infinite variation in terms of how who Christ is plays into our lives. Not that he is in any way inconsistent, but there is also this infinite, infinitely complex presence with people. And as we encounter Christ through people, through each other from different backgrounds, we have a little bit better understanding of the character of God, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. What I lament a bit, though, is that, you know, when you're talking about your experience growing up and seeing Jesus as sort of a white middle class person and feeling alienated by that picture, it saddens me that that's associated like with historic Christianity, and it's rightly associated with historic Christianity because there have been movements over the years that have depicted Jesus in that fashion. And that saddens me because there's so much room in historic Christianity for that to be blown to smithereens, because it's not a part of the core of the actual depiction of Jesus in the scriptures.
Or the actual history of the church, right?
Or the actual history of the church, yeah. And so in some ways, I lament that. And always I lament that.
So the second picture of Jesus from this week is... So I originally heard this from Dr. Perkins, John Perkins, and it's something that I won't be able to do justice to, but he walks through the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus in the Garden, and talks about how Jesus in the Garden is the black man being lynched. You know, the being falsely accused, unjustly tried, but, you know, and then up through the garden, up through the cross, right? And so I think the other image that I have of Jesus from this week is the image of George Floyd in his final moments, you know, and how Jesus identifies with the oppressed all the way, right? All the way to death. And so I think about...
And after death.
Right.
Yeah. You remember when he appears to the disciples, he's still wounded. Like in his resurrected appearance, he's still wounded. And in the book of Revelation, he's the lamb that was slain. And he's got he's got the wounds on him still. The victorious Jesus still has wounds on him. And to me, that there's something so profound about that, so puzzling in some ways, that you'd think, oh, Jesus has passed on to the other side and now he's free from all pain and suffering or something. And yet here he appears to his disciples wounded, still wounded, although not bleeding to death, you know? it's so profound. Like you're mentioning of Jesus being present with the oppressed. How did you put it? All the way, even unto death, and even after death. Mm-hmm. Says a lot. In some ways, I wonder if Jesus's solidarity with me as a white person would feel more foreign to him somehow than his solidarity with people unlike me. In other words, like, is it harder for Jesus to sympathize with my experience than it is with George Floyd? Because Jesus's lived experience in his own life was much more like his than mine. And that's not to take away from the, you know, the omnipotence and omnipresence of Jesus and all of that. But it's just kind of wondering a little bit about, I tend to think, oh yeah, Jesus understands my experience because, you know, because that's the way he lived or something. And frankly, that's your point that you're making, Stephen, shows in some ways how removed Jesus' experience was from the 21st century middle-class white experience. And in some ways it's disturbing when Christians fail to acknowledge that, and when Christians do everything in their power to squash some of the movement that's trying to be made in the Black Lives Matter and any sort of racial justice, because in some ways it's not just an attack against the movements, is it an attack against Christ, who also suffered now in those ways? I don't know. I don't know the answer, I guess, but I'm wondering.
Yeah, I think that's a good starting place for us, though, right? Is to acknowledge that we don't know. and to approach scripture and each other saying, I don't know, you know, and yeah, to be confident enough in who Christ is to be able to say, I think maybe there are some ways, Jesus, that I think I've known you that I'm not sure whether that's right or not, which is a painful question.
And to what extent is our vision of Christ and the way that we see Christ a figment of our imagination?
Yeah.
That is based on all sorts of other things other than the actuality of who he is. And that's not to be dismissive to say that somehow like all of our theological systems should be blown to smithereens. I'm also frustrated though when I hear of people who have left their faith because of a sort of portrait of Jesus that I'm not sure is actually anything close to who he actually is. And it's not a frustration of judgment towards those people. I fully understand it and fully sympathize with why they would reject such a Christ. It's a frustration with the fact that that Jesus, that's the figment of our imagination, that people have rejected, that say, therefore, I'm no longer a Christian, or therefore, I can't follow Jesus. But I wonder, is it because the Jesus we've constructed is actually a figment of our imagination? And had we really encountered Jesus as he is, might we not feel that same sense of revulsion?
It sounds like, Alicia, that's where you began to find some healing in your understanding of Christ, right? It was this deconstruction of a false Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. I just remember thinking growing up, why do we believe in this white man? And, you know, when we're Asian. And for the longest time, it was my parents took us to church and we went. It wasn't until high school that I really started to understand he came for everyone. And it was not just for a certain group of people. And that the funny thing is, I heard about Jesus through my family and at church. It wasn't through white people. But when you look at him, that was all I could see, was that he was white and he came for white people. The church talked a lot about how he grew up in, you know, the Middle East and all of that. But then I didn't fully connect with Jesus because I was Asian. It was really hard to understand that Jesus was someone who was not present in my life. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized, wow, he is here. He can live my heart through the Holy Spirit. And he is, that he came for everyone. That was mind-blowing for me to come to that realization that I didn't have to live in this box distant from Jesus, that Jesus could live in me through the Holy Spirit.
Alicia, I'm curious, as we kind of wrap up here, like what are some concrete steps that you would like to see people take?
To be open and hearing from people who do not look like you, and reading materials, listening to podcasts, listening to sermons from leaders and from others who are not white. I think that is very important, especially if you want to really allow Jesus to go to the ends of the earth. I mean, we really have to be open in understanding that Jesus came for all and not just for one group of people or one neighborhood or one church. And then partnering with other churches, the community organizations around you, and asking them where they need help and partnering. I've seen that as a leader, I've struggled with connecting with churches in general, and not just the Alliance churches, but just churches in general, to try to do like combined church services. And I usually get an absent voice or response. And it's like, oh, I don't want to keep pushing. I don't want to be the angry Asian woman again. But I would say build friendship with people who look different from you. Get to know them. I was at Bethel and a classmate named Sean Moore, he's an African-American man. And in the middle of class, we had a break and he got up and he walked right over to me. He said, are you Hmong? And I said, yeah, I'm Hmong. And he goes, I don't have any Hmong friends and I want to be your friend. And I just thought, that is so cool. Okay. And so, I mean, we're still friends today. Now I saw him in my neighborhood once. He was pastoring at a local church here. And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, passing out free food. So it's just being bold, going out and making new friends and just saying it, being very clear. Hey, I don't know much about your culture. Can you just please share with me? I want to learn. Being humble about it.
Appreciate everything you've shared with us here today. It's been really good having you on with us. Are there any other thoughts that you might have just to kind of wrap up our conversation from today before we let you go?
I just want to say thank you for allowing me a space to speak and share and to hear, validate my voice, my life, my experiences. This is one of the very first times I've ever got to share. And that is very empowering for me because a lot of people don't really want, I mean, not a lot of people. I think that we have made it a norm to not hear from women and then not to hear from Asian women. And we don't seek out opportunities to speak out all the time, especially in the Christian world. Now, we have amazing women leaders who are in the community serving in government and in different government sectors. But in the Christian denomination, especially our denomination, a lot of Asian women are invisible or unheard. And I want to change that. And whether it's one conversation at a time or sitting on a team and committee and having conversations with a larger group about the alliance and women and racism and reconciliation, all the above.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for leading people at River Life, for leading people on Facebook, for, you know, it's been such a privilege to talk with you today and to hear from you. And, you know, we had kind of written up what we were going to talk about today, and somehow images of Jesus hadn't showed up. And I'm so grateful for that conversation. I think, anyway, thank you so much for being with us and shaping our thoughts today. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Have a good week here.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. This week's music was written by Marcus Dipsilis in honor of George Floyd. We will play the whole uninterrupted song in a moment. You can also download it for free at profsinrooms.com. Just look for episode 10. First, I want to read what Marcus had to say about this composition, entitled A Dirge for the Gentle Giant. He says, "The piece is unrefined, with no discernible rhythm or timing. This is meant to symbolize the fogginess associated with a tragedy, like that of George Floyd's senseless murder by a racist police system. The eerie, unsettling pad at the bottom has an unsteady rhythm to symbolize the troubled and staggered breath of George Floyd, but also those in the Black community who feel suffocated by the injustice. The strings represent the heartstrings of the Black community, the cello of the Black fathers, the violin of the Black mothers. The antiphonal conversation between the violin and the cello symbolizes the conversations that Black fathers and mothers must have with each other every time another young Black son is killed. The piano symbolizes the coming around of the community, embracing Black fathers and mothers as they continue to antiphonalize their pain. The whole piece is 2:43, the time from when George Floyd lost consciousness until the time that his murderer finally took his knee off George's neck. The tune is cut short, just like George's life, with a solitary note, repetitive, erratic, and fading away into nothing. The final heartbeats of the gentle giant as he passes on into the safety of his savior's embrace. No more racism, no more prejudice. George is now in the presence of his maker. There is no anger or malice in this piece. No call for justice, no comfort or reassurance, only mourning and despair. We present A Dirge for the Gentle Giant.